following presentation is brought to you by Faith Presbyterian Church Reformed. Delivering today's message will be Dr. Richard Bacon.
Father, we thank Thee for Thy Word and for the principles which Thou hast given and which we might understand, for human language, that as we approach Thy Word, that we might approach Thy revelation as language which Thou hast written to us, as words which Thou hast made for us. And now as we consider these difficult semantic rules and principles, that Thou wouldst give us a heart to study, that Thou wouldst give us understanding, that we might apply ourselves to knowing Thy Word and understanding it. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Please be seated. We're continuing on, I think we're in lesson 15, in our study of the science or principles or art of hermeneutics. And hermeneutics is, it does have scientific principles, and yet the following of them is never a perfect, is never done perfectly. Difficult sometimes to know precisely which principles to apply. What we're doing right now is we're looking at a section that we're characterizing as semantic criticism. What is the science of semantics? Of meaning. The science of meaning. What gives things meaning, or what gives words or utterances, I'd prefer to say, meaning. An utterance. What is an utterance? Well, an utterance is not necessarily a single word. It's not necessarily a single phrase. It's not necessarily a single paragraph. But rather, it's something which, as a unit, has meaning. Even though an utterance might also be comprised of several utterances strung together. Go ahead and turn on the projector, if you will. The first thing that we want to look at, in fact, the thing that we're going to be looking at all afternoon today, is the structural approach to language. Can everyone see the slide or the projection? All right. The structural approach to language. In other words, here's what we're saying. We're saying that language does have a structure. We're not saying that the English language has a structure, that the Greek language has a structure, that the Hebrew language has a structure. We're saying that language, generically considered, has structure. And while that structure may vary from one language to another, that there is going to be a commonality. And those commonalities is what we're going to look at in this structural approach to language. We're going to look at such things as synchrony and diachrony. We're going to be looking at syntagmatic and paradigmatic relations and so forth. And those exist in every language. They're expressed differently in different languages, but they exist in every language. Now, first of all, what do we mean by synchrony and diachrony? Well, you can probably recognize the C-H-R-O-N root, can't you? What does that mean?
Time.
So synchrony means at the same time, and diachrony, or diachrony, means through time. So which one do you think would be more of a static study, and which do you think would be more of a historistic study, or an historical study?
Diachrony would be across, right?
So would be across time, or through time. That's right. So that would be the second one. That would be the one that's more of an historical study. In other words, how has the meaning of this word or of this phrase changed over time? Whereas synchrony is more the study of what does it mean right now, or right then when it was written. Okay? Now, the first principle is this. Why don't you cover up the slide up to where it says both. All the way up to where it says, there you go. Both have a role to play, but they must be kept distinct. We're not saying that diachrony is altogether fallacious. We're not saying that diachrony has no role to play. What we are saying is that diachrony does not determine the meaning of a word. What diachrony does is tell us how how a word changes meaning or has changed meaning over time, either up to the time that the word was used by the author of Scripture, or how it changed after that time. But it's an historical study, but it doesn't determine the meaning at the very moment that the word was written in the Bible. That's more the role of synchrony. And we're going to see that synchrony and diachrony both have a role to play, but they must be kept distinct. When we start confusing them is when we start getting into things like looking at the etymology of a word, picking some point in the etymology, or adding all of the things that a word has meant over time together, as though the real meaning is this totality of things. Both of those are illegitimate studies, or illegitimate conclusions. Drop down. We have an analogy from a chess game. Now, I know some of the boys here in the church play chess. Matthew, do you still play chess? How about you, Jeremy? You still enjoy the game like you used to? Well, if I were to set up a board for you, and I were to say, okay, after 33 moves or after 29 moves or whatever, we have these pieces left, and they're in these positions on the board. You would look at the relationship of the various pieces to one another, but you don't have to know what the 28 moves were that preceded that to be able to analyze what white or black should do next. Right? It may help you a little bit to know what your opponent has done in the few moves prior to that, to see if he's building some kind of a trap. You would agree with that. But it's not crucial to understanding the game situation to know what every move was for the last 31 moves, if we're on move number 32. Okay? Let me compare the state of the board to synchrony. There is a relationship of words in an utterance. There is a relationship of phrases in an utterance that determines the state of that utterance, but we don't have to know everything that every word has ever meant in a particular language to understand what that utterance means. Good. I'm seeing some nods. Good. So a few of you have played chess, even if you haven't spoken. Right? All right. As in chess, it is possible to understand the state of a game as a simple description of where the pieces are at a given time. Diachrony of the game is irrelevant to understanding the state of the game. Now, it may be relevant to understanding the psychology of your opponent. It may be. But it would not be relevant to understanding the state of the game. Okay, or the state of the board. Okay, drop down. Here's a couple of examples in English. We're going to also look at some examples. We're also going to look at some examples in Greek. But for those of you who are English only, I thought you might enjoy some of this. The English word nice, N-I-C-E, according to the etymologies in the dictionaries that have them, is from the Latin nescius, which means, am I translating nescius correctly? Basically ignorant or uninformed. Yeah. Well, what does that etymology have to do with the way we use the word nice? When I call somebody nice, should they consider that to be an insult? But if I called them ignorant, they might consider it an insult, right?
They will now, right?
Well, they will after I've said this. That's right. Here's the point, that the etymology of the word nice is not a clue to what it means today. It's an interesting history. It might help us to understand the history of the English language. It might help us to understand the psychology of English. It might help us understand a lot of things. But what it doesn't help us to understand is the way the word nice is used today. Unless we have a much more recent etymology. In other words, this is what it meant last Tuesday. Just, you know, very, very recent. Also, the word hussy is a doublet, not so much a doublet as a shortening, not a nickname, an abbreviation, a shortening of housewife. Well, there's absolutely nothing insulting about referring to someone as a housewife. I prefer to think of them as a homemaker. I prefer to think of them as a guardian of the home rather than a housewife. But it's not an insult to call them a housewife. Men, I'll guarantee you should not call your wives hussies tonight. Don't do that. It'd be a big mistake. I'm warning you now. Don't do it. So you see that even though the word hussy comes from housewife, so what? It's not what we mean when we use the word hussy. I shouldn't say we mean. It's not what the word hussy means when it's used in English today. Okay. Words have meanings. People have intentions. Okay, next line. So also in Greek, and I've just picked some here almost at random. Not completely at random, because I wanted some where you could see something similar in English. The word liturgia. Who knows what the word liturgia actually means? How is it used? Our liturgia. We might offer up our bodies a living sacrifice, which is our reasonable liturgia. Service or worship. In fact, it's the word from which we get the English word liturgy. Okay, so worship or service. But the etymology of the word is from laos, which means what? People, and orgeo, which means to work. So it comes from there to service, from service to worship, to a particular liturgical kind of worship, and service rather, and from there to worship. So there is a diachrony to how it goes from being the work of the people into how it becomes worship, but that's beside the point. The word does not literally mean the work of the people. Now suppose I were to say to you, look, any liturgy that doesn't involve the people standing up in the middle of the service and speaking is invalid because the very Greek word comes from the word for people doing the work. Well, that would be a doctrine based on the etymological fallacy, wouldn't it? Or diachrony rather than synchrony. You see now why I'm saying that etymology is not definitive for meaning? Again, men, if you don't understand that, at least take my word for this. Don't call your wives hussies. Okay. If you don't get anything else out of this, this is an easy one to apply. All right. And the next word then is splunkizomai. And I know it doesn't look as though there is an N in there, but the reason we get that ng sound is because of the gamma and the chi together. It gives us an ng sound. Did you know that? Okay. Some people who have learned their Greek with just, you know, from books have a tendency to overlook that. But splangizomai is a verb, and it means to have compassion. Okay, but it comes from, it's based on the idea of bowels or guts. And probably the closest thing that we would have to an English verb that's based on that would be to eviscerate. To have a gut feeling. Or we have an adjective in English, visceral. I have a visceral belief, just a gut feeling, a gut belief, right? But even at that, you see, the word does not mean anything having to do with the bowels or with the guts. What it means is to have compassion. So how much good does knowing the etymology do us? Well, it gives us some insight into the psychology of the Greek language, but it gives us no further insight at all into the meaning of splunkizomai as being to have compassion. Are you with me? You see what I'm talking about? I'm not saying that diachrony has no function at all. What I am saying, however, is that synchrony is both prior to and posterior to diachrony. We have to know what it means, and we have to know where we're going with that meaning. And then huperites was originally an under-rower, someone who worked under someone else, and it came to mean a servant. In fact, when it's referred to, when Phoebe is referred to in this light, I think it's translated helper. I think it's referred to as helper. Phoebe was my helper, and then she's also characterized as a deaconess in that passage. Is that Romans chapter 16? I commend unto you Phoebe, our sister. She's a succorer. That's what that word is, how that word is translated. succorer. I commend unto you Phoebe, our sister, which is a servant of the church, which is at Cenchrea, that you receive her in the Lord as becometh saints, and that you assist her in whatsoever business she hath need of you, for she hath been a succorer of many, a helper of many, based on the idea here of a, again, of a helper, translated succorer, but coming from, you see the word there, hooper? Hooper means under, and then to row. So to row under, and it comes to mean a helper or a succorer. But the etymology is of no help in finding the meaning. That's my only point, is that etymology is not determinative with respect to meaning of a word, either in English or in Greek or in any other language for that matter. Okay, next section. Okay, so diachronic linguistics is not illegitimate, but its use should be that of demonstrating how and why, if possible, the meaning of a word has changed over time. Two basic rules in comparing synchrony and diachrony. Two basic rules. First, a synchronic description is a prerequisite to the diachronic study at each stage of the development of a word's meaning and connotation. So if I look at a word over time, if I'm going to look at Old English, say from the 400s or around 1000 year of our Lord, something like that, then I first have to get a snapshot of what that word means in 1000 AD. Then I move on, say, to 1300 AD, I get a snapshot of what it means in 1300 AD. Then I move on maybe to 1600, I get a snapshot of what it means in 1600. Now, what is it when you show a series of snapshots one after the other? Then you've got a movie, right? So think of the diachronic linguistics as the movie that's made up of a series of snapshots. But the snapshots are prior to. The snapshots are not determined by the movie. You with me? Because we have a series of meanings. And the diachronic study might be helpful in the same way that a movie might help a golfer with his golf swing. It doesn't determine what his golf swing is. It just helps him to understand how he got out in the rough. Maybe that's not a good analogy. But the purpose of a diachronic study is you're studying history. You're not studying language. Or you're studying the history of language. Yes.
Well, if the study undertaken, if the diachronic meaning.
Wait a minute. There is no diachronic meaning.
Okay. The diachronic study.
Okay.
Well, in some cases, it may. It may not have changed much over time.
That's true.
It may really, in some cases, be related to the synchronic meaning, right?
Could be.
That's why the study
engaged. Well, the synchronic study of a word, and that's what I was getting at with these snapshots. The synchronic meaning of a word in 300 AD in English, or Anglo-Saxon, I guess, at that time, maybe, would be perhaps significantly different from the way that same word is used 1,000 years later. And so diachronic linguistics or diachronic studies are simply to see how the word has changed over time. But we're not saying that if we take this entire period now and add it all together that we have the real meaning of the word. All we're saying is that we have a whole series of meanings.
Right.
And that in 300 AD, this was the right meaning. This was the correct definition. This is the way you should have used the word. But then, and then maybe in 1600, hussy was the right thing to call your wife. Okay, but in 1996, that's not the right thing to call your wife. So the meaning has changed over time. But what has changed, I mean, we can look at that change diachronically. In fact, that's the only way we can look at it. But at some given point, say when a document is written, so we have a diary of Mr. Jones, who's writing to his wife in 1550 in Essex, England. And he uses the word hussy. We shouldn't say, oh, what's he thinking of calling his wife a hussy? You know, he must hate her, he must loathe her, he must have an extremely low opinion of her. Well, not necessarily. What we have to look at is how that word was being used in 1556 or whatever year I gave you. Okay, second rule. Adequate attention must be paid to the phenomenon of semantic change. In other words, we have to know roughly what year the document was written, or the utterance was made, I guess would be a more linguistic way of saying it. We have to know what year the utterance was made. Since it may have been written down 500 years later, but it came about as part of an oral tradition. So that there was an oral tradition for 500 years, then it was finally written down 500 years later, we don't look at what the word meant when it was written down. We look at what the word meant when it was uttered. So it would be more accurate to say we need to look at the semantic change from the time it was uttered until our day. Yes?
Isn't a perfectly good example of this is in our Psalter when they wrote it in the meter and rhyme, that they used certain words that were applicable at that time?
Sure, sure. Yeah, the question was, when we look at our Psalter, or for that matter, our King James Bible, you know, we see what is sometimes for us awkward phraseology. Now, let me qualify that. Some of that phraseology has to do with the 17th century, and some of that seeming awkwardness has to do with the philosophy of translation that was followed by the King James translators.
Well, we see that with our Constitution, of like, what does militia mean, or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Without getting into that one, that's a good example. In the Second Amendment to the Constitution, what is intended by the original framers by the word militia? And of course, another philosophical question is: then are we bound by their original intent or not? So, but yeah, there's two different things going on there. One is the intent of the writer, and the other is the meaning of the word. See, words have meanings; people have intentions. Is this about the militia, or is this about...
I said it was meaningless, but not.
Oh, well.
But there's an example in Sam and took the word of how he explains seer.
Yes.
Modern word.
Right. And that's in the Hebrew, of course. And he says, what used to be called a seer, and again, you need to think of a seer just as someone who has a vision, right? What used to be called a seer is now called a prophet, he says. A Navi. So, synchronic study, then, is both prior to and posterior to the diachronic study of a word's meaning. So, when I say prior to, I mean we have to find some point in time at which we're saying this is what the word meant at the time that it was written or the time that it was uttered. When I say posterior to, I mean the only purpose for the diachronic study is to light on something that we can come up with as a meaning. And diachrony does not give us meaning. It only gives us history.
I guess I don't understand that. If we're reading, let's say, a book that was written in 900.
Okay.
And by a diachronic study, we'll find out the meaning that it possessed in 900.
So yeah, but what we'll light on is the synchronic meaning in 900. Right, that's what we're looking for. So that's the posterior notion of synchrony. Okay. Prior means before, posterior means after. So after we've done our diachronic study, we end up with something that has to do with the year 900 AD. We're saying this is the meaning in the year 900 AD. That's why our synchronic meaning is posterior to the diachronic study. Because after we've done the diachronic study, we end up with this meaning that has... Because our diachronic study says, here's what it means in 500, 900, and 1300. Okay, we've finished our study now, we light on 900. Okay, the reason that it's prior to is because we want to know what the word means in a given utterance that was uttered on a certain day in a certain year.
Okay.
So it's prior to in the sense that we're starting by assuming that meanings can only be synchronic. That is to say, I can't use a word and assume that the way it's going to be used in 500 years is the way I'm going to use it in a sentence today. I can only use a word in a sentence the way it's used today, unless I use it incorrectly, the way it's used today. Yes?
Does the original Hebrew have the same type of changing of the words? Or
yes. Yes, yes. In fact, so much so that there are people who have done studies of books, and we'll get to this somewhat when we talk about historical criticism, introductory criticism, is that there is a sense in which we can tell the age of a book somewhat by the vocabulary that's used within the book. Some words are later words, some words use later spellings. So that there's a tendency for some Hebrew here, but there's a tendency for a lamed hey verb to become a lamed yod verb, for example. I can't think of any examples off the top of my head. But
how do you tell the age of something by the meaning of the word if the person is all a binary?
Context. We're going to talk about that next. We're going to talk about syntagmatic and paradigmatic relations.
That can run away.
You're right. You know, we're not absolutizing. You're right. We're not absolutizing any of these things. What we're doing is we're getting out our toolbox, right? We get out our toolbox. We say, "Here's our hammer," but that's not how we tighten a screw, right? I mean, we could, right? I've known people who tighten screws with hammers. I have also known people who tighten screws with wrenches. It can be done, but it's not the right tool for the job. In fact, I did a comic photo when I was in the military on a PC board. Back in those days, PC boards were a lot bigger and harder and thicker than they are nowadays. But PC board, and then I had a power drill with probably about a 3/8 inch bit, and the caption was always use the right drill for the right job. But yeah, we're getting out tools, right? We're getting out diagnostic tools. We're getting out semantic tools in the context of diagnostic tools. And one of our tools is synchronic versus diachronic linguistics or studies. But we're not going to absolutize things and say, this is the only thing that we can use. We can only use a hammer from now on. When we get to something that requires a screwdriver, we'll get the screwdriver out. Have I just about beat that illustration to death? Okay. Another question back here? If there is, just hammer away.
I'm trying to rip something.
Okay. Yeah. For the tape, he says, you're just trying to wrench something out of me. All right, next slide. Syntagmatic and paradigmatic relations. And here you're going to have to drop down to the whole of Roman numeral 1. Go all the way down to Roman numeral 2 and then back up 1. There you go. Now back up. There you go. Now, don't just read, because we need some introduction here. All I know how to do to give you what the difference is between syntagmatic and paradigmatic relations is to give you examples of it. A syntagmatic relation is a linear relation, so that if you take a sentence and have two sentences that are similarly constructed, they will have a syntagmatic relationship within that sentence, regardless of the words that are used. It's a linear relation. And here are the example. The phrase, a crown of thorns. Okay? We have three things in that phrase, a crown of thorns. We have the adjective, or it's a specific kind of an adjective called an article. The word what? Which is the article? The word a. Okay? A. Then we have a noun, crown. Then we have of thorns, which is a prepositional phrase being used as an adjectival phrase. Do you see that? So that a crown of thorns, the word crown has a syntagmatic relationship to the word a. A modifies it as an adjective or as an article, doesn't it? It has a syntagmatic relationship to the phrase of thorns, because of thorns modifies it as an adjectival phrase. Are you with me? So now, when we look at the phrase, the beauty of holiness, what relationship does the noun beauty have to the word the? It's modified by the article the, right? And what relationship does beauty have to the phrase of holiness? Of holiness is an adjectival phrase modifying the noun beauty. So we might say that beauty has the same syntagmatic relation to a and of thorns that beauty has to the and of holiness in the phrase the beauty of holiness. Basically, we're talking about a syntagmatic relation determines how you diagram a sentence. Any of you go to a school where they still teach that? Okay, you all know how to diagram a sentence? That's what we're talking about. When we talk about syntagmatic relations, we're talking about sentence diagramming. Now, here is the importance of a syntagmatic relation. A syntagmatic relationship gives us this. For example, if we use the word eat, we would not normally use as the object of the word eat, automobile. We would use words like carrot, meat, food, vegetable, but we wouldn't use, say, oh, things that go in your mouth. Right? That's, automobiles don't go in your mouth. But then we wouldn't use the word eat for words like water, coffee, or wine, as well as automobiles. So what that does is that syntagmatic relationship that eat works correctly with food, meat, vegetables, carrots, peas, onions, but doesn't work with wine, water, coffee, and automobiles, helps to establish the meaning of eat as to ingest solid food. Okay, so the importance of a syntagmatic relation for meaning is the words you can use it with. You can't use the word eat properly with the word automobile. Or you can eat in your automobile, but you can't eat your automobile. Okay? All right. Drop down now to paradigmatic. Some of you know the word paradigm. That's where we get the word paradigmatic. Okay, a paradigmatic relationship exists between words when you choose one instead of another. Here's what we mean by a paradigmatic relation. I'll give you another example. A paradigmatic relation exists between a word or linguistic unit, and by linguistic unit we're saying, for example, of thorns is a linguistic unit because it's a prepositional phrase. It's two words, right? Of sharp thorns would still be a linguistic unit. Okay, and another unit just like it, which is not the actual utterance, but which might have been chosen in its place. So, crown of thorns. I could have said a crown of gold. I could have said a crown of laurel. So in this particular utterance, laurel and gold have a paradigmatic relationship to thorns. Because I chose thorns, but I could have chosen laurel, or I could have chosen gold, and still had a sensible utterance. But I couldn't say, well, it wouldn't make sense to say spaghetti. Okay, a crown of spaghetti, and normally a crown of thorns. But the thing that draws our attention to that phrase is the fact that it is. It does have a strange syntagmatic relationship. Crown and of thorns don't usually go together. So, I give you an example in English. And I've chosen a word that has a polysemy on purpose. Okay. So, the word foot as a measure of length derives part of its meaning from the fact that it's not an inch or a yard or a mile. It's a foot. So what is that relationship? Is that a paradigmatic or a syntagmatic relation? In a particular utterance, if I say a foot of string, not a mile of string or a yard of string or an inch of string, does foot have a paradigmatic or syntagmatic relation to yard, foot, I mean yard, mile? How many say paradigmatic? How many say syntagmatic? Okay, paradigmatic is correct. Okay, because I could have chosen inch or mile or yard, but I didn't. And they would all have made sense. But it also draws part of its meaning from its syntagmatic relation to fabric, string, or lumber. So a foot of lumber is not the same thing as a foot of string. They have one thing in common. What is that? Their length. Yeah, they have that one thing in common. But a foot of string is not a foot of lumber, is not a foot of fabric. So that the word foot draws part of its syntagmatic, part of its meaning rather, from the syntagmatic relationship between what I'm measuring. And it draws part of its meaning from the paradigmatic relationship to the words I didn't choose, which would be other units of measurement. Inch, yard, mile, kilometer, meter.
Couldn't those relationships exist at the same time?
Yes, they do. Both those relationships do exist at the same time. Foot has both a paradigmatic relation to the words I didn't choose, and it also has a syntagmatic relation to whatever it's a foot of. But again, normally I wouldn't talk about a foot of butter. Right? Right? I mean, foot is not one of the things I would choose to measure butter. Sometimes if we look at the words in a sentence, each word has a meaning. We can look it up in the dictionary. There it is. But it has no referent. And a foot of butter is not a good example. The present king of France would be a good example of that. You know, what is the referent for the phrase "the present king of France"? Yeah, there's not one. Yeah, or where do I find the reference 6 silly green cows"? Yeah, I can use the words. The words have meaning. You listen to those words and say, you know what? I recognize each one of those words. I even recognize the structure as a proper structure. Right? 6, silly, green, plural noun. Right? I recognize that structure. If I said 6 silly green frogs, we might think of 6 hand puppets of Kermit, right? But if I say 6 silly green cows, we say, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. And what's wrong, of course, is there's not a referent out there in the real world, just like the present king of France.
What's the problem with idioms?
That's part of the problem with idioms. That's correct.
It's Saul among the prophets or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Now, on the other hand, we talked about a foot of butter. Actually, we didn't, did we? We talked about a foot of string, a foot of yard, a foot of fabric, a foot of Now there's an interesting thought for you. I just thought of this. That's why it's interesting to me, is because I'm still thinking about it. Is sometimes fabric is referred to as yard goods. You ever, ladies, ever heard of it referred to as yard goods? So think about a foot of yard goods. That's interesting, especially when we have two meanings in English for the word foot and at least two meanings in English for the word yard. So maybe a foot of yard goods is 12 inches of that furniture that I sit out there in the front with, or on the patio. That's a foot of yard goods. Or a foot of yard goods may be 12 inches of fabric, or it may be that furniture out in the yard that I kick. It'd be a foot. That'd be the aspect of foot. On the other hand, the word foot as a limb of the body. Okay, now we're going to talk about the foot down here, the thing I keep in my shoes. As a limb of the body draws part of its meaning from its paradigmatic relationship to hand, elbow, or knee, as in, get your elbow out of my eye or get your foot out of my eye. Right? I can choose one or the other, so it has a paradigmatic relationship to other limbs of the body. Or, it derives part, or I shouldn't say or, but and, it derives part of its meaning from its syntagmatic relationship to that shoe does not fit my foot. I know now that I'm not talking about 12 inches of fabric, right? Or put one foot in front of the other. I could say put one elbow in front of the other, but it wouldn't. Put one nose in front of the other certainly wouldn't work. And so on. So you see, every word, I want you to think of it, if you will, think of it as an XY coordinate. And where the X and Y coordinate cross, we have a field. And we're going to refer to that now as a semantic field. Not a domain yet, but a field. All right, do you have that in your vocabulary? You now have some new vocabulary, right? We're going to talk about semantic fields. And when we talk about a semantic field, it's going to combine the paradigmatic and syntagmatic relations that a word has in its utterance. So now, where do we find that in the dictionary? We don't. That's the task of exegesis, to determine the semantic field. What is its syntagmatic relation to the words around it, and what is its paradigmatic relation to other words that the author or speaker could have chosen? Okay. Anybody bored yet? Anybody not bored yet? Okay. Let's move on to the next slide, and then with this slide we'll finish up. I'm sorry?
I said, which board are you?
Which board am I referring to? I'm referring to chairman of the board. That's right. Okay, we're still under structural approach to language, the semantic field. And here's the point. A word does not have a meaning in an autonomous or independent fashion. Now, that does not mean it doesn't have a dictionary definition or a lexical definition. It does. But when you look up a word in the dictionary, if you were to look up the word, F-O-O-T, in an English dictionary, what would you find? You'd find at least two meanings, wouldn't you? At least two definitions, I should say. And which one goes in our utterance? Well, the dictionary can't tell us that. So the dictionary can't tell us what the meaning of a word is in our utterance. It can give us a list of possible definitions from which we must now choose. But it can't tell us this is autonomously, independently of context, independently of syntagmatic relations, independently of paradigmatic relations, this is what the word means. Word studies cannot be dismissed as valueless, but we must remember that meaning may be and usually is modified by context and co-text. Y'all remember the definition I gave you earlier in this course for context and co-text? Co-text are the utterances around the utterance that we're studying within the same document. Context is the historical background in which the utterance was made. Yes?
When you look up and do a word study, doesn't it help though to go to the root of the word and find it?
Well, when you look up the root of a word, you have to be very careful. That's the next thing we're coming to. And I'm going to give you a what I think is a pretty good example in English of how that would lead you astray. Let me give you just a comparable one to the one we're about to use. If I referred to the White House in America, especially if it were capitalized, I would have something very particular in mind, right? What would I have in mind? Anybody want to guess? The Presidential Mansion. Yeah, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, the Presidential Mansion. But now, where is the clue for that from the etymology of either the word white or the word house? How would I ever guess that? Yeah. So I have to have a context. And the context determines what I mean by White House. We're going to come to a very similar example. Now, we must be aware of what James Barr called illegitimate totality transfer. And you don't have to have that in your notes. But what Barr means by that is taking a whole list of meanings where we look up a word in a language-to-language lexicon and say, oh, it has these five meanings. I'm going to add them all together, come up with some kind of a conglomerate, and this is going to be the real meaning. He calls that illegitimate totality transfer. Because no one uses the word foot to mean both Well, I guess you could if you were to go out and you were to measure something by putting heel toe, heel toe, heel toe. You could possibly transfer one meaning of the word foot to the other meaning of the word foot, assuming that that limb at the end of your leg is 12 inches long.
And then you could throw in the foot of your bed.
Yeah, then you could throw in the foot of your bed, which happens to be 3 feet long because I went like this. You understand what Barr is getting at? Is that we can't just look up a word that has five possible meanings, add them together in some kind of a sum, and then say, this is the real meaning of the word. That's illegitimate in English. It's illegitimate in Greek or Hebrew as well. Okay, next point. We're going to use an example. Well, not yet. Eugene A., help me out back there. Is it Nita or Nida?
No, Nida.
Well, okay, now I'll put down three. This can be pronounced three ways. I often do that. Illegitimate totality transfer when I pronounce Lorraine Bettner Botner Botner's name. Eugene A. Nida asserts, and this is a quotation lifted right out of his article, The Implications of Contemporary Linguistics for Biblical Scholarship in JBL, asserts the correct meaning of any term is that which contributes least to the total context. Now that seems to be counterintuitive, doesn't it? And in fact, it is precisely the opposite of what most people do when they do exegesis. Most people, when they do exegesis, attempt to draw as much juice out of one word as they possibly can, don't they? We refer to that as squeeze it dry hermeneutics, or squeeze it dry exegesis. So Nita's assertion, and I'll tell you in advance that I mostly agree with him. You understand what he means, I think you will too, or what he intends. You will too, that the correct meaning of any term is that which contributes least to the total context. I'm going to give you an example in English so that you can see what he's talking about. Drop down to the example. Okay, if you look up the word green as an adjective in a spoken English dictionary, you're going to find that it has at least these three meanings. It may refer to a color. It may refer to someone who is inexperienced, or it may, as an adjective, mean inexperienced. A green worker is going to be an inexperienced worker. Or it may mean unripe. A green tomato is an unripe tomato. Now, if we were going to talk about a greenhouse, and a house can mean a dwelling, right? May I come over to your house on Tuesday, refers to your dwelling. It may refer to a lineage, right? As in the house of David, or it could refer to a business as the house of Lassiter, stationers. Have you ever seen the word house used in that way? Okay, you know what I'm talking about. Some of you are looking at me like, come on! So now let's put these two words in a syntagmatic relationship. What are we going to do? Well, the first thing that's going to happen is that inexperienced and unripe are going to drop completely out of the picture for the word green. Right? Would you all agree that greenhouse does not mean an inexperienced house or an unripe house? Houses don't ripen, do they? And houses don't gain experience, do they? So it doesn't mean an inexperienced or an unripe house. It has something to do with the color green. And also, I think you would agree that it's not talking necessarily about a business. It could be. If we talked about George's greenhouse, it could be talking about a business, but only incidentally, because he's named his business that. It could also be George's on 2nd Street. So it's only incidental that the word house is used that way. And it doesn't mean lineage. It means, in fact, the idea is it's a place where something green dwells. It's not even the color of the house itself. In fact, isn't a greenhouse kind of transparent? So the house itself isn't green. It's not really a house. So now, how much has green contributed to the meaning of this term? Less than we find in the dictionary. And how much has house contributed to the meaning of this term? Again, less than we find in the dictionary, and I would say even less than we find in any one definition in the case of both terms. Now, so what happens is we take the words green and house, or green and house from your perspective, and we place them in a syntagmatic relation, and in doing so, we minimize the semantic value of each term. Or we give them a new semantic value, a different syntagmatic value. So thus, green is only a color, and it refers etymologically to that which is grown inside the greenhouse. Green stuff is in there. That's why we call it a greenhouse. So now we're doing what kind of study? We're not doing a synchronic study anymore. Now we're doing what kind of study? A diachronic study to find out why we use the word green when it's obviously clear, transparent. Why do we call it a greenhouse? Well, etymologically, because green stuff is grown in there. And house is only a dwelling where the green things are grown. It's not a house, it's not a business, and it's not a lineage, as in the house of David. We don't mean by this the lineage of Mr. Green. Okay, drop down. Then let's take it one step further. Let's give it a new semantic relationship. So now we're going to have a new syntagmatic relationship, which means a new semantic field. Because now, if you think of it on the XY axis, we've moved over on the X axis. Right? Syntagmatically, we've moved one way or the other. But we've moved on the X axis. So the very term greenhouse, we're going to take that term and join it syntagmatically to the word effect. And now, even the very structure, the greenhouse itself, has dropped out. We're just talking about carbon dioxide allowing infrared through clouds, but not allowing ultraviolet through clouds, and destroying who knows what. I don't think even the scientists know exactly what all is being destroyed or how or why. But the fact of it is that now, what relationship does green or house have to the greenhouse effect? They've virtually disappeared. There is almost no... We can't go back etymologically. We can't go back to the basic meaning of green and learn more about the greenhouse effect than we can learn simply by looking up greenhouse effect. Nor can we learn more about greenhouse effect by looking up the word house. So that's the problem that we have with treating words as though they were autonomous units. We have to consider them in semantic fields, in their syntagmatic relationship to the words that they're being used with, and their paradigmatic, their y-axis, their paradigmatic relationship to words that could have been chosen but weren't. So that, for example, in greenhouse effect, I could have chosen the word greenhouse gases. Couldn't I? Yeah. Okay, we've got a couple of minutes left, 3 or 5. Are there any questions at this point? We've basically finished looking at structural approach. What I wanted you to see is what a semantic field is, because we're going to be talking about semantic fields when we get into discourse analysis. Yes?
Could you use greenhouse gases as synonymous with greenhouse effect?
No.
And one example would be, for instance, you could talk about reversing the greenhouse effect, but yet you could not talk about reversing the greenhouse gases.
Exactly. So by choosing the word effect rather than the word gases, that means that in this utterance, effect and gases have what kind of a relationship?
Paradigmatic
is right. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I'm trying to relate this to a common ground where I'm like understanding.
Okay, here's what we're going to do next time. We're going to use an example from Scripture where we actually do some work with semantic domains. And what we'll probably do is choose something like justification by faith.
Uh-huh. And because she was trying to express what she had gone through, and that had meaning for
right.
her name, says what the meaning is. So if you were to go find that same word somewhere else in the Hebrew, couldn't you use what the meaning was that was told by in the word? I mean, or is there a problem in doing that? Like,
Right, but yeah, I mean, yes, with qualifications. Yes, you could with qualifications. You know, if in fact there is not other evidence that that word changed meaning over time. So that, for example, the Book of Ruth was probably written about the same time as 1st and 2nd Samuel.
So there was that much difference between Hebrew.
Well,
from one, like, Abraham,
not necessarily, but. But I'm simply trying to hedge my statement around so that it doesn't become an absolute statement.
Because what you're doing, you're tearing apart a lot of the studies I enjoy too.
Well, just be careful with it. That's all I'm saying.
I like looking up things.
Sure. I'm not suggesting that you should quit. But what I am suggesting is that you should be careful.
Examples of where it says that a certain event took place at where they put the rocks up,
mm-hmm.
and they called it a certain thing because that's what it means to put those rocks up.
Right. What they call it, Joe Bob or Jim Bob?
Ebenezer. Right?
Well, there was one called Ebenezer, but wasn't there another one that they called something else?
That was just one of those descendants named Joe Bob.
Joe Bob. What was that? Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you're right. You know, we can. But again, that's the value of looking at things in a synchronistic and diachronic way, or a synchronic and diachronic way, is that we can look at what the word meant at this time. You know, maybe 1,000 years later, the word does mean the same. But remember, the Bible. You know, it might take us a few months to read it. But it took a lot longer than that to write it.
Well, it looks like the latest one that I did, I may have said it to you, like the word Berean.
Okay.
I was trying to find out what the meaning of Berean was. Mm-hmm. And we have a thought in our mind of mm-hmm. what people of Berea did.
Sure, based on Acts 17, yeah.
Right. And the word Berean in the Greek means well watered.
Mm-hmm.
So I you know, get a picture study, you know, like coming out of that.
Yeah, well, those are the things that I'm suggesting that you might want to be careful with. I'm not saying quit doing them. Particularly when you start, if you should start building doctrines and ways of life on them.
Oh, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's...
That's what the warning is.
That's my warning to you. That's my suggestion to you. Yes, is be careful. Yeah, need to be careful of... Oh, and we may have already used this illustration in the course about the lady that opened the Bible with the pin in it, you know, Judas went and hung himself and so forth. We probably all know that story. We've heard it a dozen or two times. In fact, we read that in Ecclesiastes today, didn't we? What thou doest, do with all thy might.
Well, I heard the one about where somebody proposed to a woman and she said, and she pointed out the scriptures, I would not have you, my ignorant brethren.
That's right. I would not have you, ignorant brethren. Yeah. Yeah. So I used to tell Larry Phillips that was my life verse. All right. If there are no other questions, let's stand and be dismissed.